Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck sticks, what the fuckstables, what the fuckadelics, what the fuckaholics? I am Mark Maron. This is WTF. Welcome. Welcome to the show. I am here. I'm a different person now. I'm a 51-year-old man. I'm a 51-year-old man. My birthday was on Saturday, and I'm feeling it. I don't like to admit that I'm feeling it, but I am feeling it a little bit. I don't know how I'm feeling it exactly, but I do know that almost immediately I was at LA Podfest and some pictures were taken with me, and I was looking at the pictures differently. I was seeing not a bad looking and not an unfit man, but a middle-aged man, a 51-year-old man. Something just gave way. And I always knew this would happen. It is a matter of perception, but I have to be honest with myself. You know, there is that moment in a president's career, especially a younger president. I'm not comparing myself to the president. I do not have that kind of responsibility. I do have a garage to manage, and I do have some things to clean up. But I'm by no means comparing my job or task in any way to the president. Quite honestly, I think I'm doing a more honest job in terms of occupation. But there's that weird moment where you compare pictures to first term and second term presidents, and you're like, holy shit, what happened to that guy? And it's really just aging, but it's something you don't notice until you notice it all at once. And it happened. I noticed it all at once. I looked at a picture that somebody took of myself and Amber Preston, who was on the live podcast last night, and I was like, oh my god, that look at my little middle aged head. I don't know. I don't know what's happening, but I'm going to have to accept it, aren't I? There's no reason to be one of those people. I cannot fight the tide of age. I will not dye my hair. And anybody who thinks that I do already, you can go fuck yourself. I have gray temples. The top is just naturally the way it is. I'm not dyeing anything, all right? I do know this. I do know that Rivers Cuomo is on the show. I do know that Weezer's new album, Everything Will Be All Right in the End, is coming out tomorrow. That's September 30th. It's sort of a return to form for Weezer. And when I talk to people about interviewing Rivers, they were like, oh, you know, that's not going to be easy. It's interesting how people are publicly framed as being something. You know, I did a lot of reading on him because, you know, I like Weezer, but I had to go back and sort of go through the catalog a bit and get a sense of who he is and you know, his eccentricity. But the interesting thing is, you know, you get down to just talking to a guy for an hour and you get sort of an idea of who he is. And it doesn't really match the reputation or the myth. You know, he's just a bit of a eccentric guy who he's very focused and he's holding it together, man. Also, I want to mention this, and it might seem a little out of character for me, but I don't think so. Melissa Etheridge's new album, This Is Me, M-E, comes out tomorrow, and you can get it wherever you get music. Now, here's the reason I'm telling you this. Is that Melissa stopped by the garage here. We had a great conversation. I'm going to put it up soon, so you can look forward to that. But you can get the record, This Is M-E, in the meantime. And I tell you, man, I listen to this record, and she's fucking going for it. She is rocking out at 52 or 53 or however old she is. We talked about it. I'm not saying something out of school here, because that was one of those situations where I get an opportunity to interview somebody. And it seems like, wow, I never even thought about that. But why the fuck wouldn't I want to talk to Melissa Etheridge? We had a great conversation. And that's coming up. So look forward to that, will you? So here's what's going on. Last night at LA Podfest, we did a live podcast. I also appeared on Aisha Tyler's podcast on Friday. It was a great turnout. Thanks for coming out if you were in the audience. I did a panel of who was on my panel. I'm obviously not going to post this for a bit, but it was sort of an interesting event because my niece is in town. My 15-year-old niece has been here before. I've talked about her before. I find it's a real privilege for me to have the opportunity to be the cool uncle. Now, I don't really know how to be around teenagers, but you know, I'm better at it than I thought. And what I have found, given that I only have to be a cool uncle and you know, I don't have to be parent, is that she's here for 3 days, and whatever insecurities I may have about being around her, knowing what to do with a 15-year-old, are placated very easily by just buying her whatever she wants. And then being able to say, like, wow, I can't believe your dad didn't buy that. Or, oh, that's, you know, no one was going to get that for you. Sure, I'll get it for you. It is a win-win situation. But there are educational moments that can be a bit disconcerting. So Eden and I, we went to L.A. Podfest. And, I, you know, someone's going to listen to this. And I'm going to be, look, you know, this is the life I live. All right. And you know, it's an assumption that kids today, you know, they're getting a lot more input. They know more things, or they certainly seen more things than I did when I was 15. I had to really look for it. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have access to wrong. That's one thing you get as a kid. Now is you have full open access to the world of wrong. And, you know, and wrong, I know it's a moral judgment, but you know what I'm talking about. Some things you don't need to see until you're 18 or 20 or maybe even fucking 50, to be honest with you. So we walk into PodFest and there's a lot of podcasts going on, and someone comes running up to me, a large guy with a beard who apparently works for Eddie Iff's podcast. I don't remember what that's called, but I literally had just walked in with my 15-year-old niece who, mind you, you know, looks 15. So this guy, look, I'm not going to fault him. It was an awkward moment. I'm not even that upset about it, but he comes running up. He's like, hey, man, you want to come on the show? And I'm like, what do you mean? Like, we're doing the show right now. And I'm like, I got to go, you know, prepare, and, you know, I'm going to be on Aisha's show. No, you got to come in there, man. There's a tranny in there, and he's got his dick out. And my 15-year-old niece is sitting right there. And I'm like, I don't know. I think I don't need to. No, you got to see it. You got to see it. You don't want to see tranny dick? And I'm like, you know, this is my niece. She's 15. Now, there was a couple of problems with what was going on. One, I was put in this awkward position. Now, I'm not assuming that my 15-year-old niece didn't know what he was talking about, but also there was a correction to be made. And I said, he walked away, and I'm like, please, can we not? No, we don't want to see transgender's dick. See, I had to correct. Because, you know, when after the moment had passed and it could not be erased or put back in whatever dark jar it came from, which was this large man with a beard, I had to clarify that tranny was not an appropriate term for a transgender person. So we passed on that. And then we went and did Aisha's Tyler show, and I introduced her to some of the podcast community. And then, you know, as we were walking out, my friend Sam Tripoli is running around. Sam Tripoli is a comic. And he's just walking through the hall going, did anyone see where the girl with the black dildo went? Did anyone see where the girl with the black dildo went? Literally two or three times. And I had to look at Eden, and I'm like, I didn't see anybody. Did you? No? Okay. Let's go get some ice cream or something. Do you want to? So that was an interesting non-parenting moment for me. I guess that is the tricky thing about being a parent in a broader sense, is that they're out in the world. Stuff is going to be dumped into their head, you know, one way or the other. The input is out there. They're going to be walking through this world of all information all the time. And you just got to, you know, I honestly think that at certain ages they can't absorb anything. But, man, I think I was a little violated by what happened, to be honest with you. And I'm a grown man, and I've experienced a lot of things. But it was an exciting situation. I think it's behind us, and I think we did the right thing all in all by just, you know, minding our own business and enjoying our night and not talking about it again. And in an amazing display of friendship and camaraderie, Dave Anthony, who appears on the show, Maron, is also a writer and someone I've known for a good 20 years. In front of an audience of about 250, 300 people, as I began the live WTF, came out with a box of cupcakes, and there were candles in them, and it was very sweet. And it was very hard for me to actually be a dick, which is what Dave and I do to each other. And I was a dick initially, and then I backed off it and thanked him honestly. And then a room full of podcast fans in a live situation saying happy birthday. And it was beautiful. And I made the wish I always make when I blow out the candles. I hope and wish someday I can just accept love in general and appreciate it. And I do, and I am conscious of it. I'm not going to be ungracious. I'm not just going to blow through it. When it comes at me, I'm going to feel it and not freak out. That's my dream. That's my wish. That's my hope. But I had a very nice birthday. Okay, so strap in. We're going to now have a conversation with the elusive and intense Rivers Cuomo from Weezer. Enjoy their new record. And I'll talk to you on the other side.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Of it.
Are you a musician too?
I play. You know, I don't call myself a musician. You know,
all these guitars are yours though?
Yes. Yeah, I just bought that one. I bought that Gibson there. You play Strats, right?
In the studio, I play Gibson.
Oh, really?
I usually play Rick Ocasek's Gibson Junior Les Paul.
Les Paul Junior with the one pickup.
Yeah,
I love that those things.
Yeah.
Oh, so you get that dirty sound?
Yeah, that's the Weezer sound.
Yeah, it is. That's where it comes from. That makes sense, man.
Yeah, it's his guitar.
Oh, wow.
But it's not quite reliable enough on stage. So I have like a Strat replica thing that we made.
Oh, yeah.
It's very durable.
So how are you feeling in general?
Little car sick.
Where'd you come from? Do you live here? Where do you live?
Santa Monica, which feels like a world away.
It is. If I have to go to the west side, I feel like I have to pack a tent and a lunch. It's like the worst thing that could happen is I have to go to Santa Monica. How long have you been living down there?
I first moved there in 91, and then Weezer... Weezer formed in the beginning of 92, and we all lived there, and I was going to SMC, Santa Monica City College.
When you moved out here, you moved out here from the East Coast, right?
I moved out in 89, and I went straight to Hollywood.
Yeah. Why not? Why not go throw yourself into the and get beat up? What happened that year?
That was amazing. That was the Sunset Strip was still rocking. And
89. So the hair metal was just sort of dying.
Uh-huh.
Transition period.
Well, it was in full effect when I arrived, and then it lasted about another year.
Yeah.
And I got a job at Tower Records there, and they the other employees there turned me on to Pixies and Sonic Youth and 60s records, Velvet Underground, Beach Boys. And
that was the first you'd heard of them? Really?
Oh, yeah. I was just a metal shredder guy in the 80s.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you grew up just like wailing.
Yeah.
And no one had ever introduced you to the world of sort of like thoughtful, arty kind of...
Songs. Yeah. It's all about guitar solos.
Right.
Yngwie Malmsteen.
You could... Can you do that?
I could. Yeah.
Yeah?
I was in an Yngwie cover band.
Seriously?
Yeah.
So you were that proficient a noodler?
Well, yeah. Like maybe B-plus noodler.
Did you have long hair?
Yeah.
So you did the whole thing?
I did the whole thing and moved out here with my band from Connecticut. And
to be hard rockers, to be metal dudes.
Yeah. And it didn't didn't work.
Who were the ones that made the most impact on you immediately? I'm a big Velvet Underground fan myself.
Yeah, Velvet Underground and the Pixies and the Beach Boys. Yeah, started listening to them in 91 and got Weezer together and started singing and writing lyrics as opposed to just playing solos.
You never had done that? You never really sung before?
I had when I had to, but I didn't think of myself as a lead singer because I didn't. I was like, I didn't quite have that Jeff Tate or Rob Halford high octave. Whoops, that's my phone.
That's high a good octave phone. Thing. That's a good phone sound. When you listen to the Beach Boys, though, it's weird with the Beach Boys. Like, you know, melodically and the layers of sound are amazing, but I find that there's a sadness in his singing that I cannot really tolerate for very long.
Oh, interesting.
Have you ever felt that? It's like there's a heavy-heartedness under there that I just can't handle. There's a vulnerability that just like, kills me.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I definitely hear it, but it didn't...
Wasn't just detracting...
No, I mean, that was why I was attracted to it. It's, yeah. I've heard of people that don't even hear it and don't get anything out of it, but
yeah.
You're the first person who's told me he feels it and he recognizes it and it's too much.
It's a little much, man. I've only had that happen with a few artists. Daniel Johnson is another one on his stuff, and like some of the later Fiona Apple things where it's just sort of like, oh, I don't know how to help her. You never felt that though. Well, you feel it, but it doesn't hurt you necessarily.
Yeah.
I don't know why it is. So when you first started doing the Weezer stuff, what were your, I mean, before you did the Blue Album, what were you guys really working on? Those songs or how'd you find your way, if I can be vague?
Well, we started out basically just trying to run in the opposite direction of heavy metal. I think this is before Nevermind came out, but even so we were, I guess, kind of like a Jane's Addiction, grungy, kind of a little bit more bluesy than you think of Weezer sounding. And I think I was trying to sing with a more gravelly voice, which I don't have. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you go see any of those Jane shows when they were, you know, at the beginning?
I don't know about the beginning, but in 1990, 91, I went to a couple shows, yeah.
It was pretty amazing.
Oh, yeah. It was so great to be a fan of them because it always felt like the shows were like this really cool event. Like, I remember this one show, they had you drive to a big parking lot where there were a bunch of yellow school buses and everyone gets on the buses.
Yeah.
And they drove us up to the top of a mountain.
Really?
Yeah. And they had like a games and a stage and they played their show and they were just kind of hanging out. And it seemed like Perry Farrell was just so great at hosting a party and making an event more than just a show.
Right. Well, he went out of his way. He got you all buses.
Yeah, and then they did Lollapalooza too, and that was just kind of developed that vibe. And I think I've always used him and Jane's as a role model for how to make shows feel like something special.
Well, there's an intimacy to it, you know, and there seems to be a respect for your fans because when you're unique like you guys are, and like well, they certainly were, the fans are sort of a special bunch. You got to treat them like a community on some level. So that's where you got the inspiration because you do a lot of like sort of hands-on. Fan engagement.
Yeah, we did the Hootenanny.
Yeah,
where we went on tour and instead of bringing our instruments, we had 100 fans bring their instruments and whatever it was, mariachi instruments or orchestral.
Yeah. How did that work?
Well, it was really scary. We didn't know what to expect, and every night was totally different.
An army of people with instruments.
Yeah.
How did you arrange it? What was the plan?
I think we settled on, I can't remember, 5 to 8 songs and gave them advance warning. These are the songs. Make sure you learn them, rehearse them, come prepared. And they all took it seriously. And we set it up as half show, half recording session. So
right. There'd
be several chances to get the song right. If we didn't get it right, we'd do it again. We'd move people around, get the mix right.
And, right. They must have been thrilled.
Yeah, and it came out really great, and it was really fun for us, too.
You grew up where? On the East Coast, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you were just like, obviously a metalhead. Who were your bands then? Who were you driving around listening to? You a Sabbath guy?
Nope. Sabbath was before my time.
Sure, but the records were around.
Yeah, but it sounded old-fashioned to me. I was, I think probably the first, besides Kiss in the 70s, was the first band that... defined metal is something more than just music. It was a culture and a community to belong to. Was Quiet Riot.
Okay.
So it was probably 83.
Uh-huh.
And then from there, it got into Judas Priest and Maiden, and then Metallica and Slayer, and then the Shredders, Yngwie.
Uh-huh.
I actually just made a long set of playlists in Spotify, what Rivers listened to in, and then the year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, starting from 1980, I think. And so I just filled them up with whatever I was listening to in that year.
And you can remember? I mean, for the most part?
Because I associate a record with a particular place.
Uh-huh.
I remember I was in the cafeteria at school when I first heard that's Master of Puppets or something.
Oh, really?
I was a sophomore, that sort of thing. So,
sitting with a bunch of other like metal dudes?
Yeah.
And somebody had a boombox?
Exactly. They had a boombox and they put Master of Puppets on, and there was that the nice quiet intro, and then it breaks into Battery, and I thought something had gone wrong with the guy's boombox because it was suddenly so fast.
Yeah. And then there's that moment where you realize that your life is different.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with his boombox. My life just changed forever here in the cafeteria. Music does that, man.
Yeah.
Your first record was a big record where people were like, what? Because I was in high school, man, when the Cars first record came out.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, when I knew that Ocasek was doing your record, when I heard that, and then you can hear the sound, I mean, you can hear his place in it.
Yeah.
Like, he definitely helped you guide that sound, right?
Yeah. I mean, to a certain extent, we were already, like, cut from the same cloth.
Mm-hmm.
To a certain extent, we're a Cars of our generation. But he definitely has his aesthetic that is part of what we do in the studio.
He sort of invented a pop aesthetic. I mean, for his time.
In a lot of ways, it's what he takes away from what we would do rather than what he's adding. Uh-huh. I'll give you an example on the record we were just making with him. Everything Will Be All Right in the End.
I listened to it. It's great. It's like you're back to your old stuff.
Thanks.
Do you feel that?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's half going back to classic Weezer values, but and then also half like trying things we've never tried before, but only things only we would try.
Oh, yeah? Good. I want you to tell me which ones you think that is. But go tell me about Rick, how he takes away.
Like, I know from my heavy metal roots, I have this instinct to start adding guitar harmonies. Like
the third?
Yeah, Iron Maiden or Judas Priest. And I'm always timid about doing it because, again, Weezer was a turn away from that. On this record, when I would try, I'd start to add some of that. And in some cases, he'd say, no, man, that sounds like Boston. That sounds like Styx. Nothing against those bands, but it's funny to hear his point of reference for what is overcooked.
Well, the funny thing is, the reason that they're his point of reference is those are the bands he helped bury.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, at the time, like when you guys came out, what was happening in music and what you guys were up against was the death of hair metal and the evolution into this next thing. Then he was really up against Boston and Journey and Styx. So, of course, that's his point of reference. That's hilarious. Mm-hmm. Boston. They had a clean sound.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was some produced shit. So, in working with him this time, coming full circle in a way, and is everything going to be okay in the end, Rivers? I haven't followed you as intensely as obviously some other fans, and I know that you've had your own struggles, and you're notoriously infamous in a way, not necessarily in a bad way, but you know there's a mythology around you.
Hmm.
Have you landed into something more grounded for yourself?
Oh, definitely. But I would hope that people take that title as more of a question.
Oh, good. Okay.
Than an assertion, yeah.
You should put a question mark.
Well, yeah, I like the ambiguity. And some people will be sure it's one way, and some people will be sure it's another, and that's fine.
Do you live with that ambiguity every day?
Yeah, of course.
It's a big struggle, right? What's today going to be?
It makes it all interesting.
Yeah. Whose choice was it to work with Rick again?
Well, that was, I think, almost, you know, all the choices are our choices. We have total control. So it wasn't the obvious choice when we started thinking about it. But when we realized the kind of sound we were going for and just that you know, live, four guys in a room rocking.
Yeah.
Not too many computer tricks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically how our first album sounded. Who on earth could get that sound better than Rick?
Right. And he got it. It definitely sounds that way. The Back to the Shack song, like in your mind, like looking at this song list, like in your mind, as the guy that made these songs, what do you think the songs that are going to pop? What are you hoping for the single to be?
The single is Back to the Shack.
It is. So I got it.
Yeah.
Oh, good. So that's the one that stuck. But yeah. there it seemed like to me that there was also some nostalgia and some personal history involved in the lyrics of that song.
Yeah, definitely lyrically. For me, it's like a wanting to go back to be with our, you know, the real Weezer hardcore community again. And it's over the years, it's easy for an artist to get cut off from the core people that were there at the beginning and playing in the clubs every week. We were able to get that instant feedback from our small audience and figure out where we were going, what we wanted to do. And it was kind of a collaborative process.
And with then, the fans.
Yeah. I don't know if you called them fans back then. They were more like the audience in the club. But
so you guys, when you started playing small clubs and you were, you know, your particular charisma is very unique, that I imagine that like it was sort of like it started with a few kind of nerdy people that knew that something was happening, and then it kind of slowly spread out.
Yeah, and well, we played a lot with other bands around town, so we're a lot of times we're playing for their fans.
Yeah.
You know, in that community in LA with the other bands and all the people who are going to shows, we figured out where we fit in and how we're going to be different and what we want to say, and we couldn't have done that without that weekly interaction with the audience.
Yeah.
And so Back to the Shack is saying we want to get back to that, and we've made a real point over the last 4 years to spend a lot of time with people after the shows and see what's going on in their lives and see what they're thinking of what we're doing. And
oh yeah?
Yeah.
What do you like, how do you do that? You just have a line, or you just, you know,
No, usually online they organize them themselves and say, all right, we like these five people, 10, 20 people are going to go back tonight. And
oh, so they come backstage. There's it's done through the boards, through the...
Yeah, that kind of thing, Facebook.
Right.
And
do you find you've had fans that have been there the whole time and that have some grievances sometimes?
Usually when you talk to people face-to-face, and this was what we really discovered on the Weezer cruises that we did, when you talk to people face-to-face, the overriding feeling you get from them is that they love us.
Yeah.
And they're super passionate about us, and they want us to win, and they have the best of intentions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's different from what you might see online, where sometimes it comes out, in text, it can come off as pretty negative.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard to interpret. You guys fucking suck as love.
Yeah.
Even though that guy honestly might love you. You might have just wronged him somehow that you have no control over. And they're usually the first guys that come up to you and go like, sorry, man. It's just like, I was mad and I didn't mean it.
But we've spent a lot of time listening and talking with them, and it feels like we're back in the shack now.
Yeah. How do you feel? How do you receive that love? Are you all right with it? I mean.
Absolutely. That's what I want most as an artist is to be understood and to be appreciated for who we are. And it's the greatest thing when it's we got these core people around us that feel that way.
Well, how have you, like, you know, in relation to setting the record straight or about, like, things that come at you, I mean, now that it's been, like, what, 96, 2006, 20 years since Pinkerton, are you happier now with the way it's fallen into place as an album as opposed to, you know, when it happened?
Yeah, I was devastated when it came out, and it's such a personal album, and I put everything I had into it, and it was really rejected, and I felt humiliated, and I felt guilty because, like, I kind of took my band down this road that wasn't really in anyone's interest, it seemed, at the time. But over the years, it's clear that it's really accumulated this passionate base of fans that maybe any other kind of record couldn't have for us.
Well, they got it. Well, I mean, because you, like, you know, you're a deep dude, and, you know, like, and your struggles, you know, around, you know, just being in the world and your feelings, you're a unique individual. So to most normal people or people who are just sort of like, this is one of some Weezer songs, you know, there's that moment where, like, that feeling I got, you know, or I get with Brian Wilson.
Yeah.
That, like, either people are going to, like, sort of, like, get, allow that into their hearts or sort of, like, can't, too much him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I, you know, I listened to it again recently to, you know, to talk to you, and it was, I think the reaction was so, you know, directly proportionate just to comparing it to the other record. You know, it wasn't looking at that record on its own, because if you look at it now with distance and not with expectation, you know, it makes complete sense.
Uh-huh, yeah,
you know,
totally.
It's just like culturally, they're like, this isn't like the other one.
Yeah.
And they just fucking turn on a guy.
Yep, can't blame them.
No, yes, you can blame them. You can't. But that sort of sent you in a spiral, didn't it, for like years?
Yeah, it took 5 years before I had the confidence to put out another record.
But, like, it's my understanding that you kind of, you know, did you find yourself, like, what was going on in those 5 years? I mean, were you depressed? Were you freaking out? Were you angry? Did you?
Well, it's in retrospect, it's hard to appreciate it, but it really seemed like we were done. Like, there was no hope. We were, you know, a one-hit wonder. And so...
You felt that?
Yeah. I mean, there was... It wasn't until about 99 or 2000 that we started to hear, like, wait a minute, actually, there are some people out there who like Pinkerton. There are some people who still want to see you guys live. And we started playing again in 2000 with the Warped Tour.
Yeah.
But until that point, it was just living in an apartment in West LA.
You guys were the fucking band, and you're like, we're done.
Yeah.
Ah.
Just, well, it started out innocently enough, like... all right, beginning in 98, let's get together in L.A. We'll start working on the next record. I got some songs. And then after a month or two rehearsals, it's like, all right, guys, I think this might take some time, so why don't you go take a break, do whatever you want to do. I'm just going to hole up in this rehearsal room here and write a few more songs. And then the months go by and the years go by. And before you know it, it's 2000. And
how many songs did you have?
I don't know. But
like hundreds?
Not enough good ones.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, didn't you go on some sort of almost...
A lot of bad ones.
Manic, you know, systemizing of how to do that? When did that happen?
In those years, I was... I started taking careful notes on what I was doing and trying to figure out what was working and what wasn't working and hoping that I could figure out what kind of processes would yield better results.
In just almost a mathematical way.
Well, I mean, there wasn't literally algebra or addition or division or anything like that going on. But,
well, what was the system?
I never settled on anything because it was like a moving target. I couldn't figure out. It's questions like, should I start with a concept? Should I start with a chord progression? And, you know, there's so many different variables, and I would just shift them around and then subdivide and come up with even more variables. And yeah, you can drive yourself nuts that way.
Well, did you find that you were like OCDing out, or did you find that the actual process of it was something you were maybe doing to sort of comfort yourself or feel better or to occupy yourself? Did it become like this weird, you know, you'd have people over to your apartment and you'd have stuff on the walls and be like, I'm almost there, man. How how far into it did you get?
I got real far. And I became pretty solitary too.
Right.
But I did come up with quite a few notebooks full of notes and diagrams and charts.
So you kind of had a little bit of a break, like a manic break almost.
Well, I mean, it's hard to generalize what I was feeling during those years, but it wasn't all bad. I mean, to a certain extent, I like thinking that way and working that way and doing research, and in a way it's all kind of removed from anything practical or career minded. It's just pure musical research, which I enjoy.
Yeah. Didn't you go back to school as well?
I went back to school 4 times after the first album came out and finally graduated in 2006 during those so-called dark years, though, I was not in school.
Oh, really? But before and after you were in school?
Yeah.
So after the first Weezer album comes out, you go back to college?
Yeah.
Where'd you go?
Harvard.
That's good.
Yeah, it was amazing.
You did all right in high school then, I guess.
Or no, I did badly in high school. And,
how'd you get into Harvard?
Well, from there I went, like I said before, I went to Santa Monica City right. College and did really well there.
Yeah.
And I got a year and a half of credit there. And then Weezer was on tour for supporting the first album. And I got so bored. It's just, you know, it was like the Groundhog Day thing on tour after a year and a half. And we toured through Boston, and I went up to Harvard and walked around. I was like, man, I'd just love to just take a break and read and study and, you know, meet people and have relationships. And so I filled out the application and put more emphasis on my community college transcript than my high school transcript, and they let me in.
Did they know who you were?
Yeah, I mean, that was part of my admissions essay, was talking about my experiences with the band. And
so literally you were like that you had written. So I imagine, you know, judging by the sort of reaction to the rejection of Pinkerton and the sort of like.
This is before Pinkerton.
No, right. But I'm just in is trying to figure out how your mind works, that that the repetition of the songs after a certain point on tour, let alone the sort of like, you know, the disassociation from reality and, you know, the Groundhog Day element. I imagine just your brain kind of going soft with singing that album, you know, every day for a year, just probably was like, I got to put new things in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just felt like my life was slipping by and I wasn't doing anything to reach my potential.
Was that put in you as a kid at all? I mean, or is that something you wired in? Did you feel like when you were younger there was a pressure on you to, like, you weren't doing enough? Or
no, if anything, it's the opposite. Like, I feel like there wasn't enough pressure.
Right.
There weren't enough opportunities, and just kind of left on my own.
That's almost worse.
Yeah.
Because, like, sometimes when I look back at my life, it's like the one thing I lacked was discipline. Why
yeah.
didn't somebody
yeah.
you know, make me do something?
Exactly.
Oh, you grew up with a sort of free kind of, like, parents who were on their own trips and did their own thing?
Very much so. And I'm sure I got a lot of advantages because of that. But
creativity, I bet you got.
Maybe that was one of the results. But it was, especially in my mid-20s, I often felt like, man, why didn't somebody force me to learn the piano, or why didn't somebody put me in a strict school? Or
right,
I could have become something great.
That's interesting, because I feel that myself, that there, you know, there is that, like, because there's what happens if you don't have a healthy sense of competition or achievement, or somebody doesn't force you to do things, you know, in your best interest, but you don't know at the time. Everything becomes very important. For me, like, you know, like, there's no, like, everything's life or death. There's no sort of like, oh, I guess that one didn't go well. It's like, no. Whereas I think that if someone just made you play soccer, you know, that, you know, you'd have a sense of like losing. It's okay, man.
Uh-huh.
You can go back to, you know, go back tomorrow. Like, anytime there was a rejection or a failure, it was just a personal attack on my personality, identity.
Mm.
Like, I couldn't figure out why everything was so fucking heavy to me. And I eventually tied it in with that idea that if somebody had given me some context, you know, it just, you know, disciplined me a little bit and said, you have to do this. And it's like, no, fuck you. And they're like, no, you're going to do this. And then you sort of get through it, and you take the weird hurt of learning a new thing. But you learn how to sort of take those chances without them being so threatening. Because mm-hmm. when you got to do it all on your own, you know, just to get to the point where you're going to do it, it's like, oh, God, okay. What did you study in Harvard?
I started out as a music major, and then I switched to English literature.
Uh-huh. Who was your guys? Who'd you like reading?
To this day, my favorite is Shakespeare.
You can? Oh, really?
Yeah.
You got big brain, boy. You got big
well,
brain.
Well, no, I mean, not big enough for Shakespeare, but the small percentage of his writing that I can appreciate is just unbelievable to me.
It's pretty amazing that it all came out of one guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, every 6 weeks or so, I'll do these nerd nights where I invite people on Twitter, 20, 30 people to uh-huh. come join me, and I get them all tickets and we go see Shakespeare together.
Are you able to sort of, keep it together with the narratives of those plays? Because like I can read it a bit. I never really locked in because I have a hard time reading plays. But when I see them, I have a very hard time, you know, following things.
Mm-hmm.
Do you?
Well, I studied a lot in school.
Oh, so yeah,
I've
yeah.
written essays on a lot of the plays.
So you know the arcs and the nuances.
Yeah, and I just get the DVDs. I go see them live. I read them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's only 10 or 15 that you see with any regularity. So you just watch the same ones over and over again.
Yeah, yeah.
You start to understand a little bit of it.
You know, did it do anything for your writing style? Do you think it influenced the depth or the style of the way you approach songs? Is that possible? It doesn't seem possible.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, what I get from it more than anything else is the depth of emotion you can get just from words.
And right.
Boy, it sets the bar so high, and it inspires me.
Yeah. So you just kept going back to get that English major.
Yeah.
And I know that you had a unique upbringing. I didn't do a ton of research, but can we talk about it a little bit?
Sure.
You were in Connecticut, right?
Yeah, born in New York. My parents were part of a Zen center, the first Zen center in the States in Rochester.
Yeah.
And they split up when I was about 4, and my mom took me to the Satchitananda Ashram in Connecticut.
Yeah.
Under the guru, Swami Satchitananda, who was the guy who gave the opening speech at Woodstock.
Really?
So I grew up on his ashram in Connecticut.
But is that like so he was around?
Yeah. He had several ashrams around the world. So
yeah.
He'd kind of go between them, but he was around a lot.
And was it like you ate, everyone ate together, everybody was there, it was post-60s, right, really?
Yeah, this is 70s.
Right, so, and people just lived on the property all year round?
There were a lot of people who lived on the property, and then a lot of people in the community around the property, and then also people would come from all over the world to see Satchitananda and to see the ashram.
Did you feel like so how old were you? Like, you were young, you were like 5 and 6?
Yeah, or? 4 to 11.
So you were in it.
Yeah.
And you, did you have reverence for that guy?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's hard to know how much understanding of, you know, a little kid can have or faith a little kid can have. But you know, I believed as much as a kid can believe, for sure.
But it's rare, though, as a kid, and it's unique as a kid to, you know, Jesus is one thing because, you know, he lives in the sky. But like to actually have the guy, you know, there and you know,
yeah. Well, he wasn't. No one said he was a god on earth. It was more about the practices, and we did meditation in school every day, and yoga and karma yoga, which was basically chores or service.
Sure.
Feeding ponies and
getting selfless.
Yeah, working for other people. So
uh-huh.
It was more about those kinds of things rather than worshiping a person.
Right. But there must have been that sense of reverence around.
There was a sense of like, this guy's pretty special.
Yeah. Are you a spiritual person?
Well, I definitely still meditate, and every year I go for 30 days to a meditation center and, you know, all day long, just meditate in silence.
How do you do it? Did you learn how to do it when you were a kid? Because I've been told I need to meditate, and I get antsy.
Mm. Yeah, I get antsy too.
Yeah.
After all this time, it's not easy. But that's right. I get the benefit from trying to work with that antsiness.
Yeah, what are some of, how do you do it?
Well, I do a technique called Vipassana since 2003. And it's basically just observing the sensations on my body and in as much detail as possible and without judging them or reacting to them.
Like, okay, my finger hurts.
Yeah.
It's going away.
Yeah. Not that you need to do a dialogue about it, but just really put all your attention on exactly what you're feeling.
Yeah. And what does that do?
Well, it does quite a lot.
Yeah.
Maybe more than anything else. It gives me just a little bit of separation between what's coming at me and then how I respond. So hopefully I'm responding a little more wisely now than before when I would often shoot myself in the foot.
Yeah. So you're volatile.
Angry. I've made a lot of big, stupid mistakes.
Let's make them right. What was your biggest mistake in your mind?
What was my biggest mistake? Well, I don't know if I want to expose that in public.
Oh, so it wasn't a public mistake. Like, do you have, like, because there is an element of the human mind, I guess, that, you know, you don't really want to have regrets, you know, and depending on how hard you are on yourself or what you think your transgression was, that's a life's work in and of itself, is to not to have those regrets.
Yeah. I don't know if it's so much about single big mistakes. It's more like just daily little decisions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they all add up. So I hope now that I can react with a little more calmness and wisdom and not react out of anger or defensiveness.
Yeah.
Or greed.
Right. Were you a scary guy at one time?
I've gone through so many different phases, and people who know me for a long time would agree. Like, there's times where, like, you could maybe not be able to associate one version of me with the version of me from a few years later.
And you think that was completely sort of conditional, like relative to circumstance, or do you think it's your, do you have other issues?
Well, I think through it all, I've always just been trying to figure out how to make great music and to
right.
make better music.
Yeah.
And it's driven me to do all kinds of crazy things. And at the same time, like you said, the circumstances around me change. And so I have to change.
Uh-huh. But you never thought you had like a psychological issue?
Not like a clinical issue that required medication or...
No?
No.
Well, that's good. Because that's one way to go. But that was not the way you went. You went with meditation, which is better.
Well, and for some people, I mean, I'm sure there are more extreme cases where meditation wouldn't be helpful and you need some kind of
right.
professional help.
But you never felt that?
No.
Well, that's good. That's good. That's healthy. Because do you have a fear of that, of looking at it that way? You never once thought, like, well, maybe, you know, I'm here in my apartment with a lot of papers and I'm not talking not really talking to anybody, and I'm not shaving.
I don't know. I think there was always just this, even just a tiny core inside of me that was like, I may appear completely insane to everyone else, but I know I'm the sane one.
Yeah, sure. You know what? You know who says that?
Who?
Crazy people. You seem okay, man. You seem pretty good. I was nervous. I didn't know what to. Yeah, you come with a lot of. There's a lot of things humming around you.
Really?
Idea. Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. I like your band. I've listened to it. You know, but I know there are people that are like really, you know, like that live for it.
Is somebody specific tell you something, or did you read something?
No, but you know, yeah, it's like, because I knew the big press when I think that, like initially, like right out of the gate, when the first Weezer comes out, you were like you're not a virgin maybe, or not having sex, right? That was wasn't it something? Am I?
Well, that's true, but not by choice. I wasn't a virgin, but let's see. I think when I started meditating 2003 through 2006, that's when I was celibate.
Oh, way up.
Yeah.
Because I just remember there was this, like, you know how pop culture things, I wasn't on the pulse of things, but there was this idea that you were like abstinent and, you know, you were saving up your energy to do other things. And I thought that was very deliberate and it was ascetic, you know, asceticism in a certain way, and that you had this methodology to, but it seems like there were a lot of methods going on that you were trying to feel better and comfortable and do the best creative work you can do.
Yeah. And I had experimented with celibacy earlier for the reasons you just mentioned, kind of like you want to save, I don't know.
Chi.
Yeah.
Save your
like
chi.
That. But the 3-year celibacy thing was totally different.
That was rare. But initially there was a word out was that you were doing that. You were saving your...
That would have been more in those dark years.
Okay.
When the Blue Album came out, I think... I wasn't celibate.
Right. What do you think it is about the Eastern aesthetic that you find compelling? Because I don't know much about it, but there is this sort of sense of minimalism and order, and there's an insane work ethic.
Yeah, Japan has been fascinating to me for a long time, and maybe I think everything you just mentioned has been intriguing to me, but also like the sense that they have greater control over their minds and bodies,
mm-hmm.
and just maybe growing up in the West, I felt like we were a little out of control. So I was intrigued by Japanese.
But it's also interesting because of just from talking to you for a few minutes that you know, they're very hard on themselves. They expect a lot of themselves.
Yeah.
And you know, that there's a tremendous shame around not doing all you can do and the best job possible. And there's a shame around dropping the ball, so to speak.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think, like, because, like, in that culture, like, you know, shame, the rituals around shame can, you know, be death, you know, self-inflicted death.
Uh-huh.
And that's pretty heavy, man. It's a heavy work ethic.
Yeah, I think very relatively high rate of suicide in Japan.
Right. And that I think that's probably part of it, too, huh?
Part of my fascination?
Yeah.
I just can't
escape the idea of, like, two things, you know, going to Harvard and it being Harvard and you, you know, having a tremendous amount of success already. You're like, no, I'm not there. I'm not good enough. I got to know more. I got to do this. And I got to do it at the best school in the world, you know, and then years later, you're like, I got to crack this pop song. This equation has got to be here. That's it to me. That, I mean, it's creative and it's ambitious and it's, self-actualizing, but it's also like it's a lot to put on yourself to go to Harvard. And...
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I didn't think of it that way. I guess I'm pretty driven, but as long as I'm not making myself too miserable, it's probably not a bad thing.
But you never were a drug guy, huh?
No.
That's good.
Yeah, that is good.
Because like in rock and roll, I mean, you see that shit all the time. You don't do anything?
Nope.
Never have. It's not an interest.
No, I've tried. I went through phases.
Yeah.
But since 2003, I've been totally clean and sober.
Oh yeah.
Yep.
And it just you know, on your own, you just like,
yeah,
made
just,
a decision.
Yeah, I didn't join a group, but and I didn't have any addiction, but it's, you know, that's the time I became celibate too, and started meditating, and it was actually partially inspired by this. My teacher, meditation teacher, and these courses. If you want to advance past the introductory 10-day course, and you want to get into the very serious courses, you have to leave all that stuff behind. You can't go into a 45-day meditation course just having like done a bunch of drugs and slept with a bunch of people.
Yeah,
because your mind will be going nuts, and it's so hard to make it through one of those courses. You have to be pretty balanced already.
Really?
No addictions or anything like that, yeah.
Like, I just, like, your mind does go nuts carrying all that stuff. You know, there's a, yeah, I mean, I deal, you know, it's like, you know, when you got that kind of clutter around, you know, and you realize, like, just how much you're doing to distract yourself from yourself.
Yeah.
And you know, who's involved. You know, you kind of make this list of, like, oh, my God, I'm carrying a lot of garbage. So you just got all of it.
Yeah.
So you didn't have sex for how long?
3 years.
Must have been, how was it that first time out?
Brief. No, it was great. It was my wedding night.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Do you think did it all pay off for you? I mean, do you think that period, do you think it rerouted you and it's someplace you can stay now? Do you not feel like you're going to like go off reservation again?
No, there's no way.
No good.
Yeah, I'm so much more content and
you have children now too.
Yeah, I have two kids and it's a good life and can't imagine throwing it away for something so ephemeral as
the perfect pop song
or sex or drugs.
Oh yeah. We'll keep what you want. Maybe the perfect pop song is still attainable. Now, are your folks still alive?
Yeah.
You get along with them?
Yeah.
Did you always?
Well, I've always gotten along great with my mom, and when my parents split up, my dad went, eventually he was born again and joined the army and was stationed in Germany for about 20 years. So I didn't see him or talk to him much when I was growing up.
Born again?
Yep.
Christian?
Yep. He is he's a bishop now in the Pentecostal church.
Wow. That's crazy to me. Your parents were real searchers.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Do you know much about where they came from before? Like your grandparents and stuff?
Well, my father's parents are from Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're Roman Catholic. And
right.
My grandfather was a shoe repair guy in Rochester.
God bless him.
Yeah.
In Rochester, he's a shoe repair guy?
Yeah.
It's great. You know what? You know, shoe repair guys are important. And especially at that time, you got to have your shoe repair guy.
Yeah.
Did you ever go to like his shop and stuff?
Well, his shop was in the front of the house. And
in the house you lived in?
I lived there some of the time, but I lived close by the rest of the time.
So there's that smell of leather and stuff, work being done at benches?
Yeah. From a very early age, I'll never forget that smell. And my name for him was actually Doot Doot, and that was because of the sound of his hammer.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Rhythmic.
Yeah.
Doot Doot. What did your dad do?
Well, the year I was born, actually 2 months after I was born, he played drums on a jazz record for Wayne Shorter.
Really? From Weather Report?
It was before Weather Report, right before Weather Report.
In between Bebop and Weather Report.
Yeah.
And, wow. So he's a jazz drummer.
Yeah. And I think sometime after I was born, he gave that up, and I'm not sure what he did. It's just maybe different odd jobs, maybe a painter.
Yeah.
And he was part of the Zen Center.
Right. So there was a time where your parents were divorced, yet still in the same Zen Center?
No.
He took off.
Yeah, they kind of split from each other and the Zen Center at the same time, I believe.
Were you ever into jazz at all?
I was in the high school jazz band as a guitar player.
Mm-hmm. You can really shred now. I mean, that's the interesting thing about listening to Weezer is that there is this pop, there's an idea of very definitive modern pop music and power pop music, but you know, pop chords, and then all of a sudden there's these guitar solos. You're like, what? Where the fuck did that come from? You still do a lot of them, right?
Yeah, I'm the solo guy.
Like it's astounding, dude. It's like, you know, it's like Brian May, or it's like, you know, there's just moments where, you know, you have and I think that's what makes Weezer great, is you have these like huge chords that are just sort of melodic and they have a pop sensibility. And then there's like this guitar that just comes out. It's like, where did that come from?
Huh.
It's great.
I don't even register it as something all that interesting. It's just,
it's the way you play.
Yeah.
But you're so proficient in and your heart is in your early heart is in this type of music.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's not counterintuitive, because it works fine. Music is music, but it's definitely from that world, you know, from your world, you know, it's sort of interesting, like how you must have decided the sound of Weezer, because you said earlier that, you know, Ocasek and you know, you guys knew what you were doing. You knew you were making a tremendous shift.
It was very, very intentional. We were going to restrain ourselves as much as possible and completely shift from an Yngwie type of sound to more like an amateurish thing, like Velvet Underground. Or
you loosened it up.
Yeah.
And you changed the chords.
Just to give you some specifics on guitar, you know, but in 1989 I was doing sweep picking and of course palm muting and wah-wah bar and fast picking, and all of that went out the window for the Blue Album. There's not even a single palm mute.
Mm-hmm. And you were conscious of that. You literally had to stop yourself. Your hand.
We would beat each other up if one of us accidentally played something a little shreddy.
No shreddy.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I guess that the victory of that restraint, because I mean, when you can shred, when you guys can really do it, I mean, the amount of sort of like, you know, cock-driven relief possible is profound, because you can just like, blah, 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 you can just like punch it all the way through. So there must have been, because that makes sense to me now, man. Because like, you know, when you can shred, you can push all your energy right forward. So if you're pulling all that stuff back and the power has to be in your voice and the chords, then it becomes this larger, almost like, you know, building thing.
Yeah, I think that something like that happened.
Yeah, that makes sense, man. That's exciting. But you get along with your old man now?
Yeah.
That took some time?
Well, it just took us getting back into each other's lives.
Yeah.
Like I said, he was in Germany. Now he's back. He's in Marina Del Rey, and I see him every now and then. And
gets along with the grandkids. Grandkids tend to make a big difference. And
yeah. Yeah, they love him.
And that's fucking...
He's cool.
Yeah? And he's not too... He doesn't lay the religion on you?
No. I mean, he's so passionate about his faith. And it's... When you believe something that much, and it's hard not to want to share it with other people. And, you know, in that religion, it's they want to save people. And gosh, like, of course he would want to save his son. But I think at the same time, it's you got to learn to respect other people and their point of view. And there's only so much you can do or say.
And he's okay with that?
Yeah, I mean, he invites me to see him preach, and I love going to see him preach. And
is he good?
Yeah.
Yeah. He delivers?
Yeah, it's so passionate and musical. There's like a band playing the whole time, the whole hour he's preaching, and it builds to this tremendous climax. And
oh, yeah?
It's great for me to see someone who shares genes with me performing, because I see in him the same kind of introspective person, but he's up there in the spotlight and he's got to connect to an audience. And I see the things he does and it inspires me and gives me ideas for what I can do too.
Oh yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Just there's a build to it. Like if someone's a good preacher, especially a Pentecostal preacher, there's a rhythm, right? Does he have that?
Yeah.
Does he have that rhythm?
Yeah.
Oh, that's impressive.
And I see him look at the other people up on the stage and he's connecting to the other musicians and the singers, and I can tell he's in his own little world up there with them, and that's how I feel on stage with Weezer.
Yeah, and also you know that he comes from, yeah, he's got music in him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean he played some bebop drums at some point.
Yeah,
so that's in there, and so that it's interesting to make a genetic connection, and also you specifically as a front man. Like I've had this realization recently about, you know, the nature of frontmen in general. But you're a little different in that, you know, you're such a proficient and stylized musician as well. Like some frontmen are just, you know, nut jobs who sing. But but like so much, it seems, of the tone of the music and the material within the music is really, you know, driven and compelled by your emotions and your experience. So I imagine to have that simpatico relationship with these guys, to know that they're following your brain in a certain way, but yet do their part in it, has got to be kind of a charge. But also I imagine there had to have been times where it was just sort of like, you're not getting it.
Mm.
Has there?
Well, by the time we're on tour and we're up on stage and just playing, I don't think, I'm not thinking of who came up with what at all. It's just... here we are, and let's just blow each other away with how awesome we are.
And do you do it?
Yeah.
I saw you in Bumper Shoot. What was that, 2007, 8?
Oh, yeah. Maybe even 2010.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, that wasn't a good show. I'm sorry you saw that one.
Really? You remember that?
Yeah.
Why? What happened?
I just felt really awkward.
Had it been a while?
No, I think we had played at least a few, like a week before that we've been playing, and every show had been amazing, and then that one wasn't.
Just didn't feel right.
Yeah.
Huh.
I felt self-conscious.
Oh.
Didn't get in the zone.
Oh, yeah? That still happens?
Sometimes.
Not so often.
How
does that manifest itself? What does self-conscious mean? Like you couldn't like let loose and be...
Yeah, you can't just think in too much and not... you know, self-critical thoughts rather than goosebumps.
Right. Well, that was the night, though, because it was like, you know, I'd always, you know, been familiar with a lot of you guys' stuff, but it was one of those moments for me where you guys were playing a lot of stuff from your entire catalog. And it was one of those moments where, you know, I'd listen to Weezer on and off, but it was one of those nights where I'm like, holy fuck, they got a lot of songs. You know, like, oh yeah, that's, you know what I mean? It's wild, the catalog that you've put together for yourself.
Yeah, they add up over the years. And it makes for a cool show, especially in these giant shows where there's a lot of people who aren't so familiar with us. There's a lot of songs that it turns out they know.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, because it's just like, it's almost like, you know, songs you grow up with.
Yeah.
Do you feel that, like, especially with Pinkerton and some, do you feel that you were a sort of seminal kind of motivator of, you know, what would be considered, you know, emo rock or a certain type of alternative rock? Do you feel that you've laid an influence on that? Like, even that album is as misunderstood as it was initially, I think that the people who it's important to and the musicians who thought it was a masterpiece immediately, I feel like it kind of propelled something.
Yeah. I often hear a lot of, when I meet other musicians, they bring up that album as an album that was important to them, and mm-hmm. they played those songs when they were younger.
Who do you like watching now?
Nothing comes to mind. I mean, I like watching anything. I just love music. I love watching bands and anything. It's all interesting to me.
You like being in show business?
I mean, I wouldn't think to use that word.
I know.
Phrase, but yeah, I love it.
I just want to make it old timey for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is this TV project you got going?
Honestly, I don't know much about it yet. These guys, the writer and the producers came up with this idea,
yeah,
and said, asked me if it was cool if they proceeded with it. And I said, sure. And they said, all right, we're going to call you a producer. And I said, okay. And they haven't really done anything yet, but we'll see. Like,
you have no idea? It's based on you?
I mean, I doubt it's going to have much to do with me other than just the basic premise that I lived through. I'm sure they're going to, because, I mean, my life was, you know, not all that interesting. It was a lot of studying and tests and not anything worth a TV show.
I don't know. Like, I would spend 12 episodes, you know, in the house with your notebooks.
Well, we'll see. I think they're going to come up with their own story, and it may not be about me, and I may not be involved in the process. So I was, you know, pretty surprised and freaked out that it became a big story last week when the network made that press, put out that press
Fox.
Release. And, it, you know, by the time it made it to the 10th internet headline, it was Rivers Cuomo to star in Weezer sitcom.
There you go. Better tell the guys. Yeah.
So we won't even know for a long time, but probably by next summer we'll have a better idea of what it is and if it's even going to happen.
So are you going to do, how many of those Weezer cruises did you do?
Two.
And they were just for fun?
Initially they were just for fun, but we quickly realized that it's an incredibly helpful and restorative coming together of Weezer and those core fans,
right,
where we get to learn so much about each other and bond, and it just helps give us so much focus and helps remind us of who we are deep down inside and what we want to do.
Okay, now just to end on this, on something we brought up earlier on this new record, like my impression of it on two or three listens was that it is sort of a return to form, you know, really first album form, obviously with Rick producing, and there's that sound that is sweet and poppy and has the punch and the lyrics, and there's even a hook or two, but you said that, you know, like half of it is like that, but you feel that half of it is part of an evolution that was going on, you know, all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
How do you sort of define that?
Well, even in the song Back to the Shack, it's on the surface we're talking about going back to that old sound from 94.
Yeah.
But listen to it. There's nothing like that music on the Blue Album at all. It's like a very, you know, like a big hard rock riff.
Right.
And even the chorus has like this kind of groove to it that we've never done before. So that's just an example of something that's half classic and yet half very new that we couldn't have done before.
So it's nuanced in that way in your mind that you, because of how you constructed the sound of Weezer early on, you know when you're like, well, we're rocking out a little bit. That, but maybe the common ear is not going to be able to identify it immediately.
Well, I think a lot of fans have made the same observation that I just did. Like,
yeah,
you know what? This doesn't sound like 94.
Right.
So yeah. I think the fans that are really listening won't be fooled. But there's also like this 7.5 minute quasi-instrumental at the end of the album. Of course, we had something like that on the Blue album too. But in this case, on the Blue album, it's the same four chords over and over and over again. It's like this ground bass that we are soloing over. This new one is very different because the music continually evolves underneath the solos. It's the chords never repeat, and it just goes on and on into ever new territory. And that's not something we would have done back then or could have done.
Right. Have you been performing that piece live yet?
No. We planned to do the whole album front to back in October and November in several smaller venues around the country. But we haven't actually put in the work to learn these as a four piece yet.
That's going to be kind of exciting to perform live.
It's going to be unbelievable. And it's such a technically demanding piece. And there's so many parts that we actually, our bass player had to have a new instrument built so we could pull it off. It's this double neck bass and guitar. So he's going to be joining us on the five-part solo. Our drummer also is going to have to play guitar at some point.
Really?
Yeah, so all five of us will be shredding together. Yeah,
finally,
guitar.
Finally! This is it! You've waited your whole life for this! Full circle, man.
Yeah.
So that's really exciting. So you've got like a little concept album within this album.
Yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. You're going to do a mixture of big spaces and small spaces on the tour?
Well, this first tour is just going to be pretty small spaces. I'm not sure where it's going to be in LA yet, but...
What are you thinking?
I'm thinking the Belasco Theater downtown.
Oh, yeah. I don't even know that place.
Yeah. I think it's about 1,500 capacity.
Oh, wow. Well, it was great talking to you. You seem well, and I'm happy about it.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks for talking to me, Rivers.
You're welcome.
That's it. That's our show. He's an interesting guy. He's an intense guy. I was nervous going in because I'd heard about that he was intense and difficult. But once I got the gauge on him, I felt that we had a very nice conversation, and he's a good guy, and he's keeping it together, and he's grown, and he's at a good place in his life, and I felt happy about that. What else? Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. I appreciate you listening to the show. Pick up some JustCoffee.coop at WTFpod.com. You know, leave a comment through Facebook. You know, look at the merch. We're going to restock the MTV shirts. I know, maybe I need to make some new shirts. I'm just busy. And I feel okay. Don't get me wrong, all right? I feel okay. Okay? I do. I feel all right. I'm 51. I'm okay. I'm not freaking out. Do I sound older? Do I sound... Oh, something's giving way. Something's happening. Something, I think, is relaxing. Either something's relaxing or something is giving up. Is it important to know the difference? Is it? Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.